If you turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 5, I'm going to read that chapter, which is quite a short chapter, and chapter 6, and the first verse of chapter 7. And Graham will be speaking from this passage shortly. 1 Samuel chapter 5, beginning of verse 1. After the Philistines had just been fighting Israel. Israel had thought it would be a great idea to have the Ark of the Covenant there as a kind of mascot. It didn't work. The Ark was taken by the Philistines. After the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then they carried the Ark into Dagon's temple and set it beside Dagon. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, There was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. They took Dagon and put him back in his place. But the following morning, when they rose, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. His head and hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. That is why to this day, neither the priests of Dagon nor any others who enter Dagon's temple at Ashdod step on the threshold. The Lord's hand was heavy upon the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation upon them and afflicted them with tumors. When the men of Ashdod saw what was happening, they said, "The Ark of the God of Israel must not stay here with us, because his hand is heavy upon us and upon Dagon, our God." So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and asked them, "What shall we do with the Ark of the God of Israel?" They answered, "Have the Ark of the God of Israel moved to Gath." So they moved the Ark of the God of Israel. But after they'd moved it, the Lord's hand was against that city, throwing it into a great panic. He afflicted the people of the city, both young and old, with an outbreak of tumors. So they sent the Ark of God to Ekron. As the Ark of God was entering Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "They brought the Ark of the God of Israel round to us to kill us and our people." So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and said, "Send the Ark of the God of Israel away. Let it go back to its own place, or it will kill us and our people." For death had filled the city with panic. God's hand was very heavy upon it. Those who did not die were afflicted with tumors, and the outcry of the city went up to heaven. When the Ark of the Lord had been in the Philistine territory for 7 months, the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, "What shall we do with the Ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it back to its place." They answered, "If you return the Ark of the God of Israel, do not send it away empty, but by all means send a guilt offering to him. Then you will be healed, and you will know why his hand has not been lifted from you." The Philistines asked, "What guilt offering should we send to him?" They replied, 5 gold tumors and 5 gold rats, according to the number of the Philistine rulers, because the same plague has struck both you and your rulers. Make models of the tumors and of the rats that are destroying the country, and pay honor to Israel's God. Perhaps he will lift his hand from you and your gods and your land. Why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh did when he treated them harshly? Did they not send the Israelites out so that they could go on their way? Now then, get a new cart ready with 2 cows that have calved and never been yoked. Hitch the cows to the cart, take their calves away and put them up and pen them up. Take the Ark of the Lord, put it on the cart, and in a chest beside it, put the gold objects you're sending back to him as a guilt offering. Send it on its way, but keep watching it. If it goes up to its own territory, towards Beth Shemesh, then the Lord has brought this great disaster on us. But if it does not, then we shall know that it was not his hand that struck us, and that it happened to us by chance." So they did this. They took 2 such cows, hitched them to the cart, penned them and penned up their calves. They placed the Ark of the Lord on the cart, along with the chest containing the gold rats and the models of the tumors. Then the cows went straight up towards Beth Shemesh, keeping on the road and lowing all the way. They did not turn to the right or to the left. The rulers of the Philistines followed them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were harvesting their wheat in the valley. And when they looked up and saw the ark, they rejoiced at the sight. The cart came to the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh, and there it stopped beside a large rock. The people chopped up the wood of the cart and sacrificed the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. The Levites took down the ark of the Lord, together with the chest containing the gold objects, and placed them on the large rock. On that day, the people of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and made sacrifices to the Lord. The five rulers of the Philistines saw all this, and they returned that same day to Ekron. These are the gold tumors the Philistines sent as a guilt offering to the Lord, one each for Ashdod, Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. And the number of the gold rats was according to the number of the Philistine towns belonging to the five rulers, the fortified towns with their country villages. The large rock on which they set the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. But God struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh, putting 70 of them to death because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. The people mourned because of the heavy blow the Lord had dealt them. And the men of Beth Shemesh asked, "Who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? To whom will the ark go up from here?" Then they sent messengers to the people of Kiriath Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to your place." So the men of Kiriath Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord. They took it to Abinadab's house on the hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to guard the ark of the Lord.
1 Samuel 5, 6, and a little teeny bit of 7. It's another great example of the storytelling of the writer of the book of Samuel, the books of Samuel. It's funny, it's bizarre, it's a bit yuck in places. It's really serious in talking to us about the majesty of God, his power, his almighty power, and the need that we need help in approaching him. And we're going to think about that. First of all, we're going to look at the two chapters, quick whiz through them. It starts in the first five verses of chapter 5 with Dagon, who has a great fall. The ark has been captured by the Philistines, as Robert mentioned. It's been taken to Ashdod, one of their principal cities. Had a number of rulers in each of the big cities. And in Ashdod is the temple of their god. So there'll be an idol there, a big statue there of their god Dagon. See that in verse 2. And God shows that he's really in charge by toppling Dagon and then disarming Dagon, literally. It was a common wartime practice. If you defeated an enemy, you may mutilate them, you may chop off their arms and legs or head or something just to make clear that you've completely defeated them. And that's what happens to the statue of Dagon. Then verses 6 through to 12, we read about the heavy hand of God. In Ashdod, as well as toppling Dagon, the idol of Dagon, God brings illness. He strikes down the people. It's a bit of an obscure illness as to quite what it is. It's mentioned in terms of tumours, not quite sure what that word means. A bit later on, mice are mentioned as somehow being connected with it. Maybe it was a kind of a rodent-borne plague of some sort. We're not sure. But whatever the sort of transmission method and whatever the symptoms, it was bad and the people cried out. So verse 8, they have a bit of a parliament. Political leaders, first of all, here. And they call together, verse 8, all the rulers of the Philistines and ask them, "What should we do with the Ark of the God of Israel?" And the rulers come up with this brilliant idea, which is to move it to another city. And first of all, you think, that's a really stupid idea. But just maybe, just knowing how people work, maybe the people in Gath thought, "You know what, those people in Ashdod, they're a bunch of wimps. We won't have the same problems. let's take it to Ashdod, because remember there's all these principal cities and there's probably a bit of fighting between them all. Although they're all Philistine cities, there's probably a bit of rivalry going on. So they thought, let's give it a go. Let's have it in our city and see if it brings us a bit of luck and doesn't give us tumours. But it doesn't work. And the people in Gath get sick too. And they say, brilliant idea, let's move it to Ekron. And as it's just arriving, you can kind of picture the scene. Ekron guys are going, no, we don't want the ark here. We've heard what's happened in the other cities. Don't bring it here. But it is brought there. And again, God strikes the people down. And then chapter 6. Two cows leave home. And the ark comes home. The ark's been in the Philistine territory for about 7 months by this time. And they have another parliament, another calling together of the leaders. But this time, because they've got some inkling that maybe there's a spiritual dimension to it all, they call together the priests and diviners, the kind of religious experts within the Philistines. And the advice and the decision is to send the ark back with appropriate gifts to appease Israel's God. Not sure quite what the gifts are. It includes mice and maybe some statue in the shape of a tumour. Don't know what shape that would be, but it doesn't sound very nice in the description. Not sort of thing you put on your mantelpiece, but maybe it is. I don't know. They may have looked very attractive. I've taken calves away from cows when they've just been born, and it's a bit of a scary experience. You allow the calf to be licked for a few minutes, and then you grab this calf and you take it away, or you do the other way around. You leave the calf there and you drive the cow away. And as you'd expect, cows' natural instincts are to stay with the calf. Because they're domesticated animals, they turn on you and they kind of want to get back to the calf. But thankfully, in most cases, they won't completely push you out of the way or gore you to death. But it's a bit scary. And I tell you what, for months later, because they know it was you that did it, they kind of give you a dirty look, like cows do, but especially so. So cows' natural instinct, like any mother really, would be to return to their calves. And the religious experts say, this is what you should do. You should get a cart organized and get these two cows who've just calved, and we'll take their calves away and we'll see what happens. We'll set it on its way. And if they go towards Israel, towards the territory of Israel, then you'll know that something special is happening and that it was God who was causing these tumors and so on. And it works. And in verse 12, these cows take the ark all the way to the border town in Israel of Beth Shemesh. Lowing all the way, I think it's just meaning to say the mooing that they often do when they're kind of trying to find their calves, they're doing all the way. So it's as though their kind of instincts have been redirected by God. So they're mooing, they're lowing. I won't do an impression for you, but you know what the sound is like. All the way, as though their calves are kind of that way. That's where they want to be. And the people of Beth Shemesh, that border town, and it's a Levitical town where the Levites were settled, those who were to be the priests for God. They see, they're really happy that the ark has come back, that symbol of God's presence. And they worship God, they break up the ark and they sacrifice the animals. But some of them get too presumptuous and they look into the ark. It's something that in Numbers 4 is forbidden, actually looking into the ark. And some of them, maybe 70, maybe even more, were destroyed because of that. The ark is then sent to this place called Kiriath Jearim, a Levite city again, a strategic site on a hill where there would be a proper priesthood and it would be a guarded place. So the ark had been captured by the Philistines. Wherever it went, there was illness and humiliation for the Philistines. It's returned to Israel and it's put properly back with a Levitical priesthood organized around it. That's what these couple of chapters are about. What can we learn? First of all, and it's obvious, I guess, there's only one God. There's only one God, and he never loses. There's only one God, just one, and he never loses. God is almighty, and he makes all the other gods look, frankly, stupid. He makes all the other gods look what they are, which is not gods at all. With a big letter or a lowercase letter, they're not gods. They're just nothing. They're just man-made things. And whatever gods there are, the God humiliates them. He humbles them. You see that in chapter 5, verse 4. It's brilliant, isn't it? The following morning when they rose, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. What might you want to do before the true God? You might want to bow down, face down. And that's what God causes the statue to do. It's kind of like a massive picture. The true God, not contained in the ark, but symbolized by the ark. The true God is there. And the false nothing God, bang, on the floor. Because that's what he needs to do. Because he's nothing. Just a man-made thing. And he wants to show the Philistines that the true God is there. And compared to Dagon, who has his hands cut off, the heavy hand of God is right through these chapters, isn't he? Isn't it? Sorry. Chapter 5 and verse 6. The Lord's hand was heavy upon the people of Ashdod. It's there at the end of verse 7 as well. It's there in verse 9. After they had moved it, the ark, the Lord's hand was again in that city, throwing it into great panic. And there in verse 11, they say the God's hand was heavy upon the city. Compared to Dagon, who's got no hands, God's hand of judgment in this case, is heavy, strong, it's mighty, it's invincible. He's the true God, and he never loses. You see, God was never defeated here. Even when his people are defeated, God's not defeated. He never stops working, even when his people are lost. In fact, God doesn't need the Israelites at all, does he? What were the Israelites trying to do when they lost the ark? They were trying to defeat the Philistines. They were trying to humble the Philistines. They were trying to repel the Philistines. What does God do without an army? He humbles, he repels, he humiliates, he defeats the Philistines. On his own, just with a box. That's how amazing God is. God is almighty. He's all-powerful. He's all-knowing. He is transcendent. And everything and everyone will bow and acknowledge that. God judges the people. He defeats the Philistines. He controls nature. He turns the instincts of these cows who feel inclined to abandon their calves in every detail, in big illnesses, in the brains of cows. God is almighty and God is working. And we need to know this morning that's true. We see that in history. God's the Lord of history. Rulers come and they seem to be powerful, but soon they're put in their place and they fall on their face. God is all-powerful, it's seen at the cross, where it seems as though other gods are winning. It seems that other gods are triumphant. It seems as though God has somehow been captured and hemmed in and contained and constrained. But he's not. Even at the cross, as Jesus dies, God is winning a great victory. So he's never defeated. And it will be seen at the end of time, where every supposed God and every pretension of man and every great ruler and every rich person who has ignored God and every poor person who has cursed God and everyone who's invented some amazing piece of technology and everyone who has held many in the palms of his hand and controlled lots of people, every person will bow and be toppled like Dagon and say, "The Lord, he's God. There's no other." I was reading this week, I'm sure some of you know about this already because it's been going a while, but there's an atheist church in London, the Church Without God. I think it's called the Atheist Sunday Assembly. And they have a bit of a sing-along, and they have inspirational speakers. I think they meet in a church building. They have a reflection. They have a sense of community action, and they sort of inspire people to go and do good stuff. Of course, it's not really a church without God. It's just a church with loads of gods. Loads of things put in place of God. But ultimately, if there's no God, there's no power and there's no point. Whether you worship a false God or whether you worship the idea of no God, one day you will bow and acknowledge. And those people who meet sincerely in the atheist temple and say we need to do good things as community and we need to have a good sing-along and we need to have good fun, those people will acknowledge that there is only one God and he's almighty and he never loses. And the Philistines should have realized that. You see, the ark wasn't another idol. It wasn't as though here's one idol, Dagon, here's another idol, this box thing. The ark, all that was doing was just accommodating to people the idea of God's presence, just giving them a sense of where God's presence was, symbolizing the presence of God. But the ark was never a container that constrained God. And God is never contained or restrained. You see, maybe the Israelites thought that God was, and maybe sometimes we think that God is. Maybe we feel like we've been defeated and that the ark's been captured. Maybe we feel like God isn't here anymore. He doesn't seem to be here. We seem to be losers. But God's not contained or constrained. He's never gone away. Because he's almighty. There's only one God and he never loses. What's the second thing we can learn? It's that we want to get rid of God when he challenges our idolatry. I guess part of the reason the Philistines put the Ark of God in their temple, part of it was to say, we want to show that Israel's God's been beaten. But I think part of it was that they wanted to kind of adopt Israel's God as another one of their gods. As Robert said, as a bit of a mascot, as a bit of a lucky charm for them, might help them win a bit more in battle. They had this great inclusivity policy. They were very modern. They tolerated any gods until they started to challenge their idea of God. Until that God started to actually put a claim on them, until that God showed that he was almighty. And when this God starts misbehaving, they want to get rid of him pretty quick. But what's fascinating through these chapters is the lengths that God goes to reveal himself, even though they don't want to know. You see, the story doesn't start with the defeat of the Philistines, does it? What does it start with? It starts with the toppling of Dagon. What should they have done? Thought, wow, must be something in it. There must be something to this God that is more powerful. Here's a sign from God, the true God. We need to look at it. We need to see the sign, see what it means. So God is merciful to them in that. And then merciful in judgment. They have lots of opportunities. They have a great sign with these gross tumors. That God is inflicting this illness on them. Will they repent? Will they turn around and say, this is the true God. Dagon's toppled. We can't do anything. This God seems to be all powerful. But they don't want to know. Judgment at Ashdod, Gath, at Ekron. And God is even being merciful at the end of chapter 5. Those who did not die were afflicted with tumors. And the outcry of the city went up to heaven. God hears their outcry, and in some way, he inspires the religious people to have a good idea. It's a bit kind of ritualistic and a bit weird, but a good idea that he honors and allows the cows to bring the ark home. He is being so merciful to them, and he's giving them so many signs. And of course, the last sign is that the cows come home. They bring the ark home. The diviners, the priests, those kind of people, Philistine priests, they say, tell you what, we'll do this, and if the ark is taken back to Israel, then you'll know that it's God who inflicted this illness. Very logical. So the cart goes back. What do? They watch it. They see what happens. It says the rulers saw that it went back to Israel. And they worship the true God and say, the Lord, he is God. No, they don't. They go back home and say, phew, it's got rid of that. We can be so like the Philistines, can't we? There's a brilliant expression, chapter 6, verse 6, where the diviners say, why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh did? He treated them harshly. Did they not send the Israelites out so they could go on their way? And I guess under the inspiration of God, these priests give the leaders of the Philistines a bit of a talking to. The priests, the diviners from the Philistines, as I mentioned, they recall the time of the Egyptians, and it's as though under the inspiration of God they're saying, look, you're just like the Egyptians were. They hardened their hearts. Pharaoh hardens his heart and refused to see the signs. 10 signs that the Egyptians get, and they still refuse to acknowledge that the true God is the Lord and he's truly God. And you're just being like them. And that's such a word for us. You remember when Jesus gets in a boat, he goes across to a Gentile area, and he heals a man who has a legion, 6,000 demons. He's possessed by 6,000 demons. And he heals him and puts him clothed and in his right mind. And those demons are put into a herd of pigs, and the pigs plunge down and kill themselves. And so the people in that territory, their religion is challenged, their economy is challenged by Jesus, but they should have seen the sign. Here's a man with 6,000 demons who's cured, but they see the sign, and what do they want to do? They say, can you leave, Jesus? Could you get back in the boat and go back over the other side? Because we don't want you here. They feared. Perhaps you're given over this morning to your idols. You might not call them that, but you live for yourself. There are things in your life that you couldn't possibly do without. There are things that you worship, although you might not use the word worship, but there are things that are so important to you that you couldn't let go of them. And there are things that you believe you need to survive. And when you hear about God and when you hear about his son, the Lord Jesus Christ, and when you feel the sense that God is speaking to you by the Holy Spirit, you actually recoil and you want to get away from it, or you want it to get away from you. Some of you doing that this morning, you're being like the Philistines, you're hearing the word of God, you're sensing the presence of God, but you don't want it because it challenges the things that you think are the most precious things. Don't be like the Philistines this morning. But we know that idolatry can be very subtle. We can be believers in Jesus. We can be Christians. We can be following Jesus. But still, as we learn more, it challenges our idolatry, doesn't it? Because there are things that we feel we just couldn't do without. There are things that we worship. Sometimes we worship our families. Sometimes we worship our health, the God of good health or youth. Sometimes we do worship our money. Sometimes we do worship our status. Sometimes we worship Christianity. Sometimes we worship the jobs we do in the church. We worship all kinds of things. And when we truly hear from God, and when God is truly amongst us, it challenges that, because he says, I am the true God. And we don't like that. And sometimes we want to push that away. Christian, are you doing that this morning? You're hearing from God, but it challenges your idolatry, and so you don't want to hear anymore. The Philistines are a terrible negative lesson for us because they don't listen. Will you listen? God has sent so many signs. Of course, the greatest sign is the story unfolding through the Bible of God's redemption in Jesus. There are lots of signs on the way, including the ones we've read about this morning. But ultimately, Jesus arrives on this earth and he performs so many miracles, which are signs. And he dies and he rises from the grave. The biggest, the greatest sign to us. And it's recorded for us, and probably you know about it. Here's the sign. What are you going to do with that sign? Say, I don't want to know any more about that because it's challenging me, or I really need to know this God. I don't quite understand the whole story, but I need to know more about this God and what happened with Jesus. What is going on? Because I'm realizing he's the only true God. And of course, as we realize that the Lord is God and he's almighty, and as rather than trying to get rid of him, we try and include him, we realize this third point, that we need someone who can stand before the Lord for us. As we read and as we thought, the ark comes back to Israel. But some people looked in the ark and they were struck down. And verse 20 raises a very interesting question. The men of Beth Shemesh asked, who can stand in the presence of the Lord, the Holy God? To whom will the ark go up from here? The Israelites realize that although God can be close, he's still holy. And they still need a priestly office. They still need to be obedient to the way God has said that they should approach him. So they organize themselves with a proper Levitical, the proper tribe of Israel, priesthood. They realize the only way they can approach him is through that priestly office that he'd set up through Moses. We want the presence of God. If we're in our right minds, of course we do, because he's the only true God. And we want the almighty power of God, but we can't stand the perfect justice of God. So really, we ask the same question that the Israelites did. Who can stand before the Lord? And it's an expression that's like the idea of the priest who stands to minister in worship. Who can stand before the Lord? And there's a sort of an answer for Israel, but it's not the ultimate answer. The ultimate answer to who can stand before the Lord is given when Jesus arrives. Who can stand in the presence of God? Jesus. Who is the perfect eternal high priest? Jesus. Who is the one who gives his own life as a sacrifice, and it's a perfect sacrifice that does not need to be repeated? Jesus. Who can bring us into the presence of God? Who can allow us to behold the face of God without perishing like the Israelites at Beth Shemesh? Who can do that? It's Jesus. That's the great news of the gospel. It's a scary, fearsome thing that these guys look into this box and they're struck down and they're so scared by it. And if we realized how holy God was and how we can't approach him because of our frailty and sin, we would be scared too. But there's an answer to the question, who will stand? And the answer is Jesus. And how can you stand before the holy God? It's because of Jesus. You need to be in Jesus, meaning you need to put your trust in Jesus and say, I rely on you, Jesus, for bringing me into the presence of God. I depend completely on your sacrifice to take away the penalty for my sin. I depend completely on your perfect life as my perfection. And I place my trust in you, and so I can stand before a holy God as my Father and as my friend. Is that you this morning? Who can stand before the Lord? You can, because of Jesus. Will you see then this morning the almighty power of God? Will you give up on your idols? Will you stop treating God like a mascot that you want to combine with the other things that you put your trust in? Will you realize that he's the sovereign king? And will you this morning be so happy that Jesus is on your side and that Jesus can be your high priest who brings you into the presence of God without fear?